History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. In the 1880s and 1890s, there was a scramble among inventors and tinkerers to create the first motion picture camera. By this time, it was clear that anyone who could successfully invent and patent a motion picture camera would earn a fortune. Many inventions were almost there, but not quite. Edward Muybridge developed chronophotography in the 1870s, where he most famously took a number of pictures of a horse in motion and through a sort of flipbook technique made it look like it was moving, but this wasn't quite it. In 1889, William Kennedy Dixon, who worked in Thomas Edison's lab, developed a kinetoscope that could show a reel 1.5 minutes long, but it couldn't be projected on a screen. A singular watcher had to look at it through a peephole device to view a motion picture loop. But the man who invented the first surviving motion picture is Louis Le Prince. He was a French artist and inventor who worked on the daguerreotype and took photos of such people as Queen Victoria, and he recorded the earliest known motion picture in 1888. This was a garden scene of his family that lasted 2 seconds long. Later that year, he filmed a short sequence of traffic on Leeds Bridge in England. So the question is, if he created the first successful motion picture camera, why don't we know about him? Why isn't he as famous as the Wright brothers? Well, the reason is, in September 1890, he was preparing for a trip to the United States to display his technology and publicly premiere it, but before then, he decided to return to France to visit his brother. He took a train to Paris, but his friends missed him there, and he was never seen again by his friends or family. For over a century, there have been theories about what happened to him. Did he commit suicide? Was his disappearance ordered by his family because of his numerous debts? Did Thomas Edison, who was absolutely no stranger to playing hardball when it came to securing patents, order a hit on him? This is one of the biggest unsolved mysteries in the last century and a half. To discuss this, and also a history of film and technology, and whether Thomas Edison was really as good or as bad as they say, is Paul Fisher, who's the author of the new book, The Man Who Invented Motion Pictures, A True Tale of Obsession, Murder, and the Movies. We'll get into Le Prince's history, the history of film, how he came up with all sorts of false starts trying to make a successful motion picture camera, including one device where 16 cameras were placed all next to each other. And overall, the impact of Le Prince's work on centuries of filmmakers and why it's so important to restore Le Prince's place in history. Hope you enjoy this discussion with Paul Fisher. In this episode, we're exploring the very earliest days of the film industry and the disappearance of the man that you and many others say is the true inventor of motion picture technology. You are a researcher and also a screenwriter, and perhaps it's worthwhile to take a moment here in the beginning to understand the importance of the invention of the film camera, because your job would look very different without it. So a job like yours didn't exist before the video camera. What would a screenwriter do, and what would their job look like before the film industry came about?
I imagine if you're writing fiction stories for entertainment that are meant to be enjoyed in a way similar to film, I guess the closest thing would have been the stage, people writing for plays and little one actors and local entertainments, or if it wasn't necessarily in a house, it would have been writing plays and skits for the fair, the carnival, or touring around and that kind of thing. That might have been the main thing. And then alongside that, there were other forms of entertainment, like magic lanterns that had narratives on slides. People needed to write those. Panoramas and dioramas, where people might have needed to come up with a way to travel through this experience. But I guess there's nothing in the sense necessarily of a screenwriter as close to writing for the stage. And it was one of the interesting things for me as a film history nerd most of my life. Screenwriting wasn't necessarily the only job that didn't exist, not only, obviously before film was invented, but even in the early years. Because in writing this, I kind of had to reimagine what the medium of film was as it was being invented by these different people, as opposed to what we think of it as now, because we make many assumptions. There really were developments of history. It wasn't necessarily a given that films would have been fiction or feature length or enjoyed in groups for a long amount of time. And so in the era of Louis Le Prince and other pioneers in the 1880s, they were coming up with what moving images might mean. And it took a while for that to mean stories that someone will need to write. So I don't know, maybe I would have written stuff for the stage and maybe I would have done another form of writing. But the concept of writing for something played out on a screen might not even have occurred to many people, even in the first few years after the medium was invented, which is interesting.
Right. I ask that because it's easy to take for granted how much the film industry has changed and to look at the before and after period, because the film industry was probably the fastest growing industry in the world in the early 20th century. And now there are screenwriters, maybe the very top ones could get seven-figure payouts for a script, but a professional like that simply wouldn't have existed beforehand. Well, looking at the man who kicked off a lot of this, Louis Le Prince, can you describe his career before he began working on his early motion picture camera? He was involved with many of the cutting-edge technologies of the 19th century.
He was very broadly read and broadly interested in an autodidact kind of way. So Le Prince, to picture him visually before he starts working on the technology, let's say early 1880s, he's in his early 40s, very tall, very striking man, French, with one of those showy Victorian beards, in his case, a houlihy, which is like the kind of mutton chops that meet at the mustache but leave your chin bare. Kind of stylish, middle-class background. And Le Prince was one of those people, he'd been born in France to an army officer father. And so he was petit bourgeois, middle class. And the world he was born into, to a great degree, was a world of horse carts and, you know, handwritten letters and, you know, a Europe in which most people never traveled outside of their own country and probably never very far from their own village, practically speaking. And by the time he was an adult, the world had kind of been turned upside down in a way that feels very current and modern to us now. But he'd been born into this much slower version of the world, and technology had exploded through the Industrial Revolution. So by the time he's an adult and he's married, there are steamships that can take you to America in a week or 10 days, and there's phonographs and prototype telephones and photography that is changing the way people think about themselves. And the first, you know, rough electric lights. And I guess a little bit in the same way that if he'd been born, you know, before mobile phones and the internet and all this stuff, within a lifetime, within, you know, half a lifetime, suddenly, you know, while sitting at home on video calls and super fast internet and all this different stuff. And so his world had changed that quickly, if not more so. And he was one of those people who had the relative means and the time and the interest to kind of engage with different parts of this evolving world. And he was very curious to explore different ways that the world was being newly understood. And so Le Prince, as a young man, was fascinated with painting. He had an artist's sensibility, but he also went to university to study chemistry and optics, the science of how the eye works, because he was fascinated by those things. And he was an amateur photographer, which, you know, has that element of being an artist and creativity, but especially at the time, also involved chemistry and mechanics quite a lot. And because people, you know, bought their emulsions, made their own emulsions, had glass plates, had to develop things a certain way. It was a lot more technical. And he was quite technical minded. And so he has all these interests. And then he meets a woman called Lizzie Whitley, who is English, and marries her and moves back with her to Leeds, where she was from. And Leeds is one of the engines of the Industrial Revolution. It's one big iron forge. And Le Prince's new father-in-law runs one of these iron forges and makes boilers and valves and mechanical equipment for steam trains. And so Le Prince, who up until this point had been interested in all these different things, but kind of a dilettante, starts working for this family firm as a technical draftsman and starts taking on an added interest in engineering design. And his father-in-law, Joseph Whitley, was also one of those men who had worked out that in this big technological industrial boom, a man could suddenly become something much more than he had been if he just had a patentable idea. So there was this concept that if you had an idea before all of this, you might be able to build something cool, you might be able to sell something very original, others might copy. But suddenly there was a whole legal framework that if you came up with something new and useful and potentially profitable, you could make it yours in law. by getting a patent, and you would be the only person able to sell it in a certain territory, and you can make a lot of money. And there were people in Leeds who had started, like Joseph Whitley, you know, sleeves rolled up, workers' coveralls on the factory floor, who then had come up with a different little valve for a train boiler, sold that to the National Rail. And fast forward 20 years, they're wearing three-piece suits and living in a big mansion, and they're running for mayor, and they're funding the local university, and, you know, kind of catapulting themselves upwards socially. And so the prince also discovers this kind of mindset, this idea that, oh, being creative and coming up with new things doesn't necessarily just have to be a kind of badge of honor or personal ambition, but it can be a sustainable way to go through life. It can be a way to make a living, and it can be a way to be socially relevant. And, you know, in parallel to this, in the United States and around the world, Thomas Edison had become extremely famous as kind of the prime example of this kind of person. Someone who, you know, if you go with the simplified Edison myth, was essentially born in a shack, traveled around the trains, didn't have very much money, but then through the force of his genius, made himself a millionaire. So once he moves to Leeds, which is in the 1870s, Le Prince starts experimenting with bringing together all his different interests to try and find a way to use all the stuff he knows to invent interesting things. And that starts in kind of a quiet, simple way, where he comes up with ways to fire photographs onto glass plates in China. You know, if you imagine the kind of coronation tea sets that English people love, it was an early version of that kind of thing. And he tried to patent those, and he started a school of art and tried that version of making an income. And he was kind of finding his way through things. And then the way his records remember it, and the way his wife remembered it, there was one day working in his shed in the back of the house where he's handling these photographs that he's trying to put in the kiln and fire onto some base, Chinaware. And as he's carrying a couple of photographs, he kind of trips or slips, and they slide in his hand, and they superimpose for a second. And the person on both frames, as they move in his hand, one on top of the other, that person looks like they're moving. And it seems like that moment immediately in Le Prince's brain made him think, this is the one. That looked like it moved just because the photographs moved in the right way. And I'm interested in photography. I know how the eye works. That's kind of persistence of vision coming into play. My kids have a magic lantern, which they love, but is really just still slides being thrown onto the wall. Imagine how much they would love it if I could put stuff on the wall. There wasn't just slides, but it was moving like it was real life. And suddenly he'd found, oh, this is the thing that as an artist and a technically minded tinkerer and a photographer, and as someone who's already interested in this idea of patenting new ideas, this is something wholly and entirely new. Where if I was able to find a way to make photographs move, not by accident, but on purpose, then I could, you know, instead of taking a moment of life and freezing it, which is what a photograph does, I could take a series of moments and replay it. And nothing that happens in life would have to be lost because I could just keep it in this box and put it back on the wall and preserve it forever. And that would be huge. And another kind of really compelling aspect to Le Prince, probably particularly for me, who as you said, I'm seeped in film and I love film, is he was unique in that very early on, he had that sense of what that medium might mean. A lot of the other early cinema pioneers, whether it's Edison or the Lumiere brothers or other people working in England and Germany and America and France at the time, most of those people were kind of pursuing moving images as an innovation. And they thought, I can sell this, or it'll work, or it'll be a product, it'll be a toy that will entertain people for a bit. And Le Prince was the first person on the record that we know of who thought and spoke a lot and was obsessed with this idea of, whoa, no, this changes everything. This would mean I could see how someone lives on the other end of the world. And Le Prince was someone who'd been in a war between the German and the French, as someone who'd been born in a town right on the border between German and France, and who was conscious that if he'd been born on a different year, he might have been German and fought on that side. But he was born in this year, so he was French and born on this side. And he had this thought that if I could make a camera like this, a device like this, and you can film someone, let's say, from Germany or from somewhere else, and show that to the quote-unquote enemy side, then we'd all realize we're just people, and it'd be much more difficult to kill each other. And if you were able to take a camera like this, I'm paraphrasing his wife here, discussing something they spoke about. If you were able to take a camera like this to a battlefield and actually show people what war is like, especially in that modern age with Krupp cannons and artillery shells and mechanized violence, who would support any war? Who would support sending their kids to any draft? And so on top of the entertainment value and on top of the informational and educational value, he really had this immediate sense of this will change the way we relate to one another for the better. And that kind of fueled his ambition and his obsession to achieve this. And I just found with all these things put together, he was just a really fascinating, complex, obsessive character, very much of his time. Because another thing about the invention of film is that a few years after it, by the 20th century, inventions become kind of capitalized. And by that point, everyone's like Thomas Edison, you know, they're funded by bankers and they have labs and they have staff and their intelligence or creativity or ideas have become assets. But Le Prince is one of those last few people of that generation, of that world, where people came up with stuff most commonly as amateurs, most commonly out of the blue. And he pursued this idea, you know, a great financial cost and personal cost to himself, not because it was a job, not because it was an expectation, but because as a guy, he had this vision, which is always a great person to write about.
He has a unique background that makes him well-suited for this. When he's growing up, he's working in his father's friend's studio on the early technology of the daguerreotype, which is a form of primitive photography. You can see a photo of President Andrew Jackson in the 1840s on this medium if listeners want to get a sense of what these look like. He's taking portraits of Queen Victoria through the Leeds Technical School of Art. So he understands the potential of this, as you said. And I would love you to describe this process of invention, because as you noted, he's an amateur. This is still the era of the tinkerer inventor. And in the early stages of creating a new technology, there are all sorts of approaches that inventors are taking, similar to the early stages of flight, where you'll see goofy old videos of people with bat wings running around. And then after the invention happens, these other alternate forms die off, and there's a convergent evolution where everything takes on one form. After a while, all airplanes look similar, all cars look similar. But in the early speculative stages, you'll have wildly varying approaches. And this describes Le Prince's method too. And I love his early camera with 16 lenses. It reminds me of the behind-the-scenes pictures of The Matrix, where they're doing the bullet time and the rotating spinning cameras, where there are multiple cameras surrounding one person, so you can create that image. Now, I don't know if that's accurate or not, but can you describe his approach to the creation of motion picture camera and the starts, the stops, the dead ends, and what he ultimately ended up with?
For sure. And that's exactly right. So like I can touch on a couple examples here, but to start with Le Prince, so the place he starts from is, okay, this is photography. So what I'm trying to do is instead of taking one photograph, I'm trying to take a whole bunch of photographs. And the process, as you're talking about, is a string of problems that need solving, and experimenting with different solutions to those problems. So Le Prince starts his process going, okay, I need, for persistence of vision, which is this theory they had at the time that your eye kind of bridged the gaps between images, and that's why when you close your eye, you can still kind of retain kind of an outline of what you were looking at if it was bright on the pupil. Le Prince figures he needs about, let's say, at least 10 photographs a second to capture motion and replay motion. The equipment available at the time for photographers was most people took photographs on glass plates and others took photographs on small frames on a paper roll, which were made by George Eastman, who later invented the Kodak. And so Le Prince builds a first camera to experiment with both. And he needs quite a bright light to go through the back of the camera to illuminate the frames through the lens so he can capture the picture and the chemicals on each image, on each frame. And so as he begins, the glass plates are shattering because moving at this speed, there's no way to keep them steady. The paper is ripping. It's catching fire from the heat of the lamp. And so he figures, all right, so I can't move these that quickly without them breaking or ripping. So I'll need to put in something to keep them steady. So I'll get some belts, some metal belts, and I'll slide the glass plates and the paper in and that'll go through the camera and that'll be fine. So he tries that. The glass plates are so heavy and the machinery is such a mess that the camera now starts shaking and rattling and making an ungodly noise. And the pictures are useless because they're being shot through a lens that's vibrating. So, okay, next problem. Maybe I'm trying to make them move through the lens too quickly. But if I had separate lenses, then maybe they could move slower, because then I'd have one set of lenses taking 5 pictures a second, the other one taking 5 pictures a second, that's half the speed, then 10 pictures a second, I'll try that. So he starts experimenting with a camera with 3 lenses, 2 lenses, and then the one that you saw that's well known, which is 16 lenses. So he had 2 batteries of 8, and he tried to work out a system where each lens would take pictures in alternating order. And then he would take these photographs out of the camera, develop them, and then put them through a projector. Now the problem is, because they're taken from these lenses that are one next to one another on the face of this camera, they're not exactly the same point of view. So when I play them back, it looks like the people are moving 1 or 2 to the left, to the right, popping up and down. It doesn't actually look like movement. It looks like I've stitched photographs together, which could already have been done and wasn't the true motion he was looking for. And so then he gets onto the stage of this invention that we can consider him making actual motion pictures, which is, I need to find a way to do this with one lens. It has to be one unified point of view through the same lens. And I've got to somehow figure out a way to get images that are bright enough that don't rip or break or catch fire reliably, because I'm going to try and sell this to people where it's going to work 99.5% of the time. And this is a point in the process where Le Prince and a bunch of other people kind of get stuck in the same way on their different projects. So to speak to what you were saying, Le Prince's 16-lens camera, in a weird way, is almost the opposite of that Matrix camera, because it's a bunch of different lenses trying to copy one point of view. The 16-lens the Matrix kind of camera is weirdly closer to something Edward Muybridge, was a photographer and moving image pioneer, was doing around that time, which is Muybridge was taking photographs of horses and later people and other animals. And he wasn't so much interested in making moving images, even though he would display them that way in a little animated zoetrope when he did lectures. But he was interested in taking enough photographs that he could break down movement into a series of very precise instantaneous stills. So Muybridge approaches his innovation with, speed is important to me. Not so much that I can restitch the movement together, but that I can get very instantaneous, very clear images. And so he tinkers with shutter speeds and with ways to activate the shutter instantaneously. And his problem becomes, oh, I can figure out how to make a camera go immediately once, but I can't figure out how to make it go immediately over and over again. So what he did in his early experiments was he would arrange 16, 20 cameras in a line in front of a kind of gridded background. And as a subject, an animal or a person moved, either the subject or Muybridge and his staff would activate the shutters. And then because the background was identical in every picture, because he'd made it look the same, he could kind of get these photographs that were seen from different points of view, but close enough that if you just looked at them or manipulated them, you could stitch them back together, which is really kind of the bullet time thing where you take 360-degree video of someone and then you can stitch it together so the camera moves around that axis. So that was kind of his approach. There was a French scientist called Etienne Jules Marais who was trying to do a similar thing, but he was interested in catching birds in flight. So he has this extra problem of, I don't know how to point the camera up there and I don't know how to move it quick enough. And so what Marais did is he came up with a gun. He customized essentially a rifle to put little glass plates into where, you know, I guess your bullet or your projectile would have been. And so now he could hold this rifle, point it at the sky, and if he saw a bird, pull the trigger, take a picture. And there's a famous letter of Marais writing to his mom saying, you know, she's asking what he's up to. And he's like, well, I've invented a gun which kills nothing, but that's great news. And so even just the concept of a camera being a camera, all these different guys had different ways of going about it. And later on, you know, Thomas Edison would work on a peep show device. You know, on a big cabinet, goggles at the top, you press your face to it and you can see the motion pictures playing in there. And it never really occurred to him that you could or should project them. Whereas to others, projection was a given. For Le Prince, for instance, a lot of the difficulties he encountered were in this trouble that he would perfect a version of the camera, he thought, and then try and apply those same principles to a projector, and the projector would start falling apart. The projector wouldn't be bright enough, or would catch fire, or would move too loud for the experience to work, or all these different things. And they were all working in an environment where parallel inventions were kind of setting the speed of how fast they could go. So people had thought about the potential for moving images decades earlier, but photographic cameras weren't good enough for it. And then the daguerreotype comes along in the 40s, which is quick enough. You know, it takes several seconds to take a picture, but that's quicker than what happened before. And sharp enough that now you can take photographs of people and you can take portraits and you can show people in a way that's recognizable. So now people start thinking, okay, if we could figure out a way to make this fast enough to take people in the wild, that would be cool. And in Muybridge, again, in the 1870s, he comes up with the instantaneous shutter, which is now you don't need to wait, you know, 10, 12 seconds without moving for a sharp photograph. I can take a picture of a horse trotting, and the shutter and the exposure is so quick that I can get a sharp image of that. And, you know, without instantaneous shutters, motion pictures aren't possible because you need the pictures, again, to move 10, 20, 24 frames a second through the camera. And then by the late 1880s, where Le Prince has his one-lens camera, has his one-lens projector, he's figured out the light, he's figured out the brightness, he's figured out the general mechanics of the camera, so he can bring it to a location. It's not shaking and popping like a Tommy gun. The problem is still these paper rolls and these glass plates, and that's the same problem for everybody else. Until a bunch of inventors in the United States, John Carbutt, George Eastman, the Reverend Hannibal Goodwin, they all around the same time alight on this idea that there's this first industrialized plastic called celluloid that's been around for decades, and no one has any idea what to do with it. People are trying to sell it as a way to make cheap billiard balls, as a way to make cheap dentures, as a cheaper and more ethical way to replace ivory. So if you want piano keys, you know, personal objects of adornment, you could use celluloid, but it's plastic, and no one really loves the idea of this material made completely in a grubby factory instead of you know, ivory or china or all this other stuff that's thought of as nicer and more sophisticated, until these people, these inventors, realize, oh wait, the stuff that's great for celluloid is it's kind of translucent, so it's going to be really responsive to photographic chemicals, and it's flexible, so we can put it in one of those rolls like the paper rolls. And it's super tough. It's really, really hard to break. And so maybe if George Eastman's making so much money from these paper rolls of film that still tear, that still kind of sometimes kind of blotch and blister in the heat of the camera, maybe if we make film out of the celluloid thing, not only are the materials cheap because it's all synthetic and we make it in factories and we can industrialize it, but it's an improvement on that. And we can kind of, in the case of Eastman's competitors, we can take over a bit of that market. And in the case of George Eastman's thinking, I can stay ahead of the other guys. And there's no thinking in these businessmen, in these inventors' minds about motion pictures. They're just trying to come up with a roll of film that's better than the previous one. Because people used to lug around glass plates. Then they got the paper roll of film. You don't need to carry a big suitcase of glass plates anymore. Now we bring you the next thing. Celluloid. Your pictures are going to be better and sharper. They're going to get damaged less often. It's going to give you a more reliable exposure and look. It's the next new thing. But a side effect of that, a byproduct of that, is people like Le Prince and Marais and Edison working on moving picture cameras, which is, again, not the market. It's a dozen people in the world. Read about this new plastic, this new photographic base, and they all think suddenly, this is exactly what I've been waiting for. This is the last thing I need for this to work. And so the final scramble to invent motion pictures is trying to get their hands on these rolls. The rolls don't fit their cameras. Can we copy them? Can we duplicate them? Can we cut them? Can we go back to the source and then make our own rolls? And Le Prince was one of the first people, A, to cotton onto the celluloid idea, and B, to figure out how to use it. And, you know, back to your original point, by this point, even as Le Prince makes his first films in 1888, the inner mechanisms of his camera are pretty much like the mechanisms in a modern film camera. They work essentially the same way. It's recognizable as a film camera. There were people working for a documentary crew. I think about a decade ago now, maybe a bit less, who built a replica, an exact replica of Le Prince's original one lens camera and put modern film through it, and it worked exactly the way you'd expect. But other than that, a lot of the stuff that kind of cemented and standardized film was still being figured out. There were people taking pictures that were in round frames and rectangular frames and square frames, and there were people working with pictures on belts and pictures that were perforated and pictures. And so it took a little bit of time for all of that to get standardized, because they were all, from their own points of view, as you were saying, making it up as they were going along. And, you know, someone like Edison would have had his lab and his tinkerers, and you can go downstairs to the chemicals vault and try different things. But people like Le Prince were really just, you know, in a funny way, like, I was just thinking, my daughter has one of those Rosie Revere engineer books. She's 7 years old. That's about teaching you to like embrace failure, and you try things and they don't work out. And the way people like Le Prince went about inventing things is very similar to that little 7 year old in the book going, well, I guess I'll tape a plunger to a toilet to a light bulb and come up with something. He was doing that kind of thing of, okay, that doesn't work, I'll toss it. That does work, I'll keep it. There's a pottery studio over there, so I'll use that. There's this over here, so I'll use that. And really making it up as they went along, at least in the early stages of figuring it out.
It seems like all the ingredients are there. He's invented his camera, his single lens camera. Celluloid is available. He is able to film some scenes, and you can see online on his Wikipedia page what he filmed of road traffic scene, his son playing the accordion. He's ready for a triumphal visit to the United States to announce his technology. If he has his patent in hand, then presumably extraordinary wealth is awaiting him. But then tragedy strikes. So what happens as he's preparing to go to the United States, and why doesn't the success come to him?
So this is what we know. So in 1889, which is the last year that we know of Louis Le Prince being alive, he's working in England, because his father-in-law had this factory and a house he could live in. And because Le Prince was paranoid about kind of intellectual property theft in the United States. So he's working in England with a couple of guys that he's found down the street, a carpenter and a mechanic. And he's taken his films, the films that still exist, the Round A Garden scene, the Melodeon scene, and Leeds Bridge. And he's got patents for his camera and projector in a half dozen countries. And by all accounts in his correspondence and everything, he's finally thrilled. This machine works. It's ready to go. There's a record of him meeting the secretary of the Paris Opera to discuss whether they might want to use the invention. And his wife and his kids are back in New York, where they had lived briefly before Louis came back to England to work. And he tells his wife, I'm ready to go. We need a venue. Can you find somewhere? And so Lizzie rents this huge historic mansion in uptown New York by the park called the Jumel Mansion, which at the time was very well known because George Washington had stayed there during the Independence Wars, the first full cabinet meeting with Washington and Alexander Hamilton and Jefferson and everybody had been held in that building before the Capitol had been decided. And a great socialite, Elizabeth Jumel, had lived there. And so it was a very well-known, very prestigious, very glamorous venue. And there was a room in the back, Washington's cabinet room. They had clouds on the walls and beautiful light and great big windows that could be closed to make it dark. And so Lizzie goes, I'm going to rent this place. And that cabinet room in the back, that meeting room with the clouds and everything, that's going to be perfect. It'll be bright with clouds. We close these blinds, you turn on the camera, and you could take the people watching back to England or back to anywhere you want. And that's a fantastic setting for a premiere. And my sense was, you know, both of them being kind of like old world continentals had this idea, the premiere will be a couple dozen influential newspaper men and New York socialites. We'll do a kind of soft launch type thing. And so all of this is documented. Louis tells the people he works with, I am going back to America. Can you pack up my stuff? We're good to go. And before he goes back to America, he decides, I'm going to go briefly to France, where I'm from. I'm going to see my brother one last time, see his family, say goodbye, and sort out some stuff we need to sort out about admin and our mother's estate and an inheritance and the kind of stuff you would do when you're now going back halfway across the world and it takes 5 days to cable each other anything. So So Le Prince goes back to Dijon, which is a town near the south of France, and he spends the weekend with his brother. And on September 16th, 1890, he says goodbye to his brother and his nieces and nephew, and he gets on a train for Paris. And he has friends from England who will be waiting for him in Paris. Then they will all travel back to Leeds in England together. And then a few days later, I think this is a Monday or Tuesday, and Le Prince had booked his passage for the Friday. A few days later, he's going to go to New York and finally, after nearly a decade of working on this thing, reveal his invention to the world and finally reap the fruits of his labor. The problem is, Louis's brother and his family see him getting on the train. They testify later that they saw him getting on the train. The people waiting for him at the other end wait for him to get off the train, and he never appears. And it seems somewhere along the train journey, he's vanished, gone. So one interesting thing is that no one realizes anything's amiss for a little while, because Louis's brother puts him on the train and then puts it out of his mind. Louis's gone. He's on his way to New York. Louis's English friends waiting in Paris don't see him coming off the train. And they figure, as people did more commonly at the time, without, you know, obviously text messages or direct communication of that ilk, they figure, ah, he must have been delayed or stayed in Dijon a little bit longer. We don't have time to wait for him. Let's go back to England. Meanwhile, Le Prince's wife and kids, they're in New York, and they think everything's going fine until a week goes by, 2 weeks go by, 3 weeks go by. And Lizzie writes back home to other members of the family saying, hey, you know, Louis usually writes me a letter every week on the dot. And the first week it didn't come, I figured he was busy or there was a delay. The second week it didn't come, I was like, no biggie, he'll be here anytime soon. But now I'm getting a bit concerned because I haven't heard anything in 3 weeks, and that's very unlike him. And so her friends in England say, oh, I think he's stuck around in France for a bit. We'll cable down there and see what's up. So they cable down there, and the brother in France says, oh no, he got on the train. I thought he was in England for the last 3 weeks. So he was back in New York. Everything was fine. And so it's about a month before anybody even realizes something's wrong. So it's almost kind of this cold case as it starts. But what they're left with is Le Prince has disappeared somewhere along this train journey. No body's found. He's never heard from again. He doesn't come back to claim his equipment. His, you know, luggage, hand luggage, if he was traveling light, is never found. No body like his is picked up along the train journey. There's no reports either in the press or from the train company of any incidents on the train. He's just gone. And that's what they're left with. And as a corollary to that, for Le Prince's family, they declare him missing. And what that meant at the time in the law was if somebody was missing, until they were declared dead, which meant a body being found or a period of 7 years elapsing, you can't use any of their stuff, including their intellectual property. So Lizzie has this big house, this camera, this projector, and these great ambitions, and she is not allowed to exploit this intellectual property. It's not hers, it's his, and he's not dead yet, even though he's gone. And that's the mystery that kind of cuts him out of the official history of moving pictures, because no one knows what happened to him.
Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. First, I want to give a shout out to all the great podcasts on the Parthenon Podcast Network, including This American President, which you can find if you go to parthenonpodcast.com. Well, here the story splits. For on one track, you have the question of what happens to Le Prince, and then the other track is film history. First of all, let's look at some of the theories, because he was at an early stage credited as a pioneer of film. So the question of his disappearance has swirled for decades, and there were many theories that swirled around, many of them unsubstantiated. Perhaps the most interesting, although not well sourced, is that this was a patent wars hit by Edison. And Edison's easy to make out a villain because he knew how to play the dirty game of 19th century capitalism. And some people, maybe at an early stage, made him to be a saint as the greatest example of Yankee ingenuity. But then the pendulum, I think, has swung where he was seen as someone who exploited his betters, Nikola Tesla, Le Prince, and others, and didn't have an original idea, but knew how to exploit people in the undefined world of patent law. I don't take either tack. I think he was a hard worker. He had very rough edges. But all that to be said, what is the theory of Edison and patent wars with what happened to Le Prince?
The really interesting aspect of that is that you're right. It's not very well sourced, but it also goes right back to the source, right? In the sense that it comes from Le Prince's family. So Le Prince disappears in September 1890. By October, his family realized something's wrong. And then by the spring of the following year, so just a few months later, Lizzie Le Prince wakes up one day and the front page of the New York Sun is Thomas Edison's newest wonder. And Thomas Edison is out announcing he's invented motion pictures. And the thing he's talking about sounds like it works quite a lot like the thing Le Prince was working on. And he's talking about it in the same words Le Prince was talking about it. And Lizzie, in her grief, gets upset and bitter. And then friends of hers start popping around the house, sending telegrams or whatever, saying, oh, have you read The Sun today? I didn't realize Louis had sold his invention to Thomas Edison. I didn't realize Louis and Thomas Edison were working together. Or congratulations to Louis. I guess Thomas Edison's taken up his thing. Or have you seen that Edison thing? That sounds an awful lot like Louis's thing. And so she starts getting suspicious. And then over the years, as Edison makes money from this invention, and as the Le Princes are unable to even kind of make their case, because again, missing for 7 years, can't touch that patent, it's not yours, it's his, he might come back. That suspicion grows into even more anger. And as time passes, Lizzie starts seeing everything in a kind of tragic pattern. So she realizes that some of Edison's patent lawyers had worked with Le Prince as patent lawyers for a while. So that's a link. That must mean they told him about Le Prince's invention, when really most likely it just means the good patent lawyers in New York work for a whole bunch of other people. You know, she hears Edison talk about himself in a kind of self-aggrandizing way, which was his way. And that really rubs her the wrong way. You know, why does he not give other people credit? He doesn't because he's a thief. And so this theory that Edison got rid of Le Prince to steal his invention is unsourced, but starts very close to Le Prince in the sense that it's born from Lizzie's grief. And it's stuck because it's such a great tantalizing possibility. You know, it's this kind of, but you know, I was talking to a film company about the film rights to the book, and they were going, you know, but we'd have Thomas Edison be the villain. And I would go, okay, well, that's a lie. And they would go, yeah, but it's a good lie. It's so sexy. And so I think that kind of myth has continue to this day, to where if you look up Louis Le Prince, the first thing you'll read about is, did Thomas Edison kill him? Was Thomas Edison involved? Because it's a really good story, but it's actually really, really easy to discount. And it's really easy to discount in a way that is of service to Le Prince, because for most of the bulk of the time that Le Prince was exploring motion pictures, Thomas Edison had no interest, hadn't approached it yet. And really, in 1888, when Le Prince has already made his first motion picture, Edison is just getting out the blocks. And not just that, but it's very clear in the record that for all his flaws, Edison wasn't a mob boss. You know what I mean? He wasn't sending two guys with guns to a train in Paris to make people sleep with the fishes. He had other more efficient ways to get his way, which he actually would use later against the Le Princes when their own claims came up. And you know, I'm a little bit like you. So it was really interesting when I started writing this book 3 years ago, and I would tell people this pitch, you're completely right that the pendulum on Edison has swung so far the other way that it was really difficult for me to have any conversation where someone didn't go, that he was a fraud, wasn't he? He was a thief and a crook and a liar and a fiction. And what I found writing the book is that same thing where you land kind of in the middle, in a way that's really interesting for the history of invention, which was that Edison, by all accounts, was a genius. And, you know, maybe he had a knack for quote unquote finishing other people's ideas, but that's also how innovation works. You know, stuff gets you 70% of the way, or you take this and combine it with that. And he had an amazing mind for kind of getting stuff over the finish line, which is how this stuff works. But he was also not particularly ethical, and very much into himself. And, you know, by the time this story happens in the late 1880s, because this is the other thing, there's several Edisons, right? The way there's several people along their lives. So Edison, long before this kind of phase of his life, starts his career, does all the stuff for Western Union, invents his version of the quadruplex telegraph, becomes extremely famous, is very good at using the press, is very good at promoting himself, is extremely intelligent and of the time. By the time this story starts, which is the late 1880s, he's in his new lab in West Orange, not Menlo Park. He's got a new wife, and he's actually in a place where his public image is kind of dented because he's been trying so hard to keep up with this public persona of the Wizard of Menlo Park who can do everything, that there are rumblings that he nicks other people's ideas, but there's even more damaging rumors and jokes in the press and caricatures of him that he's kind of become a bit of a shyster, that he announces stuff that he can never actually put to market because it doesn't work. Because he'll come out and say, I've invented the phonograph and it's fantastic. And a newspaper man will go, I've heard it. It's the greatest thing ever. And then 3 years later, the thing's still not on the market. And then it comes on the market and it doesn't work and no one likes it. And so he's got this image, this developing image of someone who used to be great, but now can't recapture that lightning in a bottle and keeps on talking as if he has and never delivering. And this is problematic because he's got this brand new massive lab. He's bogged down by this very public war over electric current that he's having with George Westinghouse. And he's sort of someone needing a public reinvention. And I found that on the one part, very human. And on the second part, really interesting, right? Because rather than being the genius he's been lionized as, and rather than being the fraud that he's been dismissed as, he kind of felt very modern to me. He felt like Steve Jobs.
Right. I was thinking that too.
Steve Jobs isn't in the lab putting chips in the iPhone. He's on the stage, the way Thomas Edison was in the newspapers. He's pointing the people who work for him in the direction that he thinks is going to work. You know, no styluses, this, that, and the other. The way Thomas Edison would point his staff in the right direction and supervise everything. He's got a brand, right? Steve Jobs had a turtleneck and the glasses, and Edison had the very deliberate workman's chore coat. And they're both backed by venture capitalists. And they both have to come out every year, every other year with something amazing, because that's the persona. And none of the stuff Edison did, at least that we know of, and he's been covered very intensively, none of the stuff that he did is any different from what every Fortune 500 company does today as a matter of routine. If there was competition threatening to dig into his profits, then he sued him and he harassed him. And he used his notoriety and his wealth to try and, you know, push them to the side. If there were workers who wanted to unionize in any of his businesses, then he tried to bust up the unions the way Starbucks or Amazon do. If there was someone who came up with what seemed like a great idea, but Edison felt like, oh, I can bring this to market, then he would copy it or buy it out, the way Facebook does with every startup on the internet. And so it was really interesting to me that with 140 years, 120 years distance, we want to go, well, Edison was a villain. He was a horrible person and we shouldn't celebrate him. But I am at the same time going to celebrate Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk and all these other guys.
Right.
Even though he's the original model. And there's all, you know, there's almost, if there's any injustice in Edison's taking the credit for movies originally, it might have been more towards this young Scotsman called W.K.L. Dixon, who worked for Edison and who actually did the work of inventing their version of a motion picture camera. And, you know, not only was kind of like kept in the public dark by Edison, because again, in a very modern way, if you were a mucker and you're working for Edison, this is work for hire. You know, it's like, if you invent Jafar, you haven't invented Jafar. That's Disney's character. So it's very similar. Dixon invents this kinetoscope, and everybody knows full well Thomas Edison will come out and say, that's mine. The same way an iPhone we associate with Steve Jobs, not with Bob down in welding or engineering or whatever. So Dixon did want to try and get more credit and did want to try and get advancement and, you know, didn't get it, which I guess was understood in the contract, but then was fired and called a traitor and a cheat. And when he started up with another motion picture camera, Edison sued and attacked him. And so Edison's, you know, treatment of his own ex-employee was probably more reprehensible, if you want to use that word, than anything he did to LePrince, because I really think Thomas Edison was not aware of Louis LePrince in any way, shape, or form, really. He might have seen his name in the Scientific American when trying to talk about motion pictures, because LePrince had the patents, and he certainly would have heard of his name in the lawsuits later on if he paid attention. But I think Lizzie's grief kind of giving birth to this embittered paranoia, then kind of metastasizing into the thing you were talking about, where it's fashionable now to think of Edison as, oh yeah, I can imagine him killing somebody to take their stuff, has made that myth kind of stick. And it's a weird red herring for the book, because I was very conscious that I only want to use it as a red herring through Lizzie's point of view. And it's going to be very quick in the book that we realize, please only take this as the point of view of one person. Because as a serious, you know, researcher, writer, or someone trying to write seriously and respectfully about history, it would be dishonest for me even to dangle Edison as a serious suspect for more than the first little third setup here, because there's just nothing in it.
It's a very interesting point you make, that those wanting to option your work and produce it, they want to push in the direction of Edison, making him the villain. Yet if you had released your book, say, 40 years ago, it would be much easier to make him a hero or not have that gravitational pull to make him the villain when he was regarded more highly. I think of the first Back to the Future movie, when Doc Brown has a picture of Edison and he's talking to him as if he's his friend. Tom, what am I going to do? 1.21 gigawatts. So he was still, I suppose, regarded 40 years ago. And just perhaps to tie a bow on that myth, you reference an 1898 case in which there's litigation between Edison and the Mutoscope Company regarding the creation of motion picture camera. And Le Prince's achievements are cited, and Le Prince's son gives a testimony. So does this case give credence to the idea that Edison invented, or his company invented, the motion picture camera independently?
It doesn't. That's a really fascinating thing. So, you know, and first on the thing you were saying before about Edison's image, this is a tangent, but the one thing Edison, when he had 20 years later, when he had his own Edison Motion Picture Company, realized very well was that you could use film to make yourself look good. So there was a ton of early Thomas Edison biopics kind of endorsed or approved or smiled upon by him. And motion pictures cemented that myth of him into the public persona in a way that was more lasting than the papers themselves would have been. So yeah, 1898, Edison, you know, motion pictures are everywhere now. The Lumiere brothers have got their cinematograph, stuff's being projected. There are basically pop-up movie houses. It's a huge industry. And W.K.L. Dixon, who used to work for Edison, is now working for these other entrepreneurs at American Mutoscope. And Edison's in a tricky position, because without Dixon, he's improving his motion picture cameras slower than he'd like. And Edison, for all his genius, you can tell from his writings at the time, he didn't get the movie thing. He didn't know how it worked. He didn't know what was necessary or required. He kind of thought it was like a phonograph, but with images rather than sound. And so he misses the boat of projection. And he's still got the kinetoscope, which is a kind of peep show googly eye device thing. Everybody uses one person at a time. And everybody else is moving on to projection. And Mutoscope, where Dixon has moved on to, has the best images available at the time. And Edison, whether it was emotional or calculated or a bit of both, seems to have had this feeling of, this can't happen. I didn't just lay claim to this machine. This whole medium, anybody making images move for entertainment, is ripping me off. And he starts serving lawsuits on smaller production companies. You know, you got to pay me a license fee or get my approval or go out of business. And a lot of them fold because they're small companies, and Edison has got JP Morgan money, and they're not going to survive it. The big fish is Mutoscope, because it's become a really big company and its product is really well liked. And within Mutoscope is Dixon, the former protege. So it's got a personal edge. So finally, Edison in 1898 sues American Mutoscope and Biograph for patent infringement. And the lawyers for the Mutoscope, trying to build a case, go through patent history, and they realize, wait, there's this guy called Louis Le Something who had a patent before anybody else. What's happened to that guy? Turns out that guy's disappeared. Turns out no one could touch his patents. But it's now 7.5 years after he disappeared. And so if we could find his wife, find his family, and convince them to go down to the mayor's office and declare him officially dead, then we can use this to show that Thomas Edison can't lay claim to an industry or to a medium when he's not even the first person to have come up with it. And so they find Lizzie, who by now is living in a small apartment uptown with her two daughters, and pitch her this idea. And the Laprinces had kind of given up on restoring Louis's legacy. You know, his son Adolf had tried to write to newspapers and tried to write essays, and it sounded far-fetched, as it would. If people are making millions from movies and some kid writes to you going, oh, my dad came up with it first, but like he's disappeared, you'd be like, that sounds fake. So this is a sudden, perfectly timed, unexpected opportunity to finally get something of theirs back. And so Adolf sails back to England, gets the camera, the projector, the old bits of films. He gets sworn testimony from 24 people. He builds the strongest case possible. Lizzie goes down to the New York mayor's office. She declares that she hasn't heard from Louis. His body hasn't been found, has him declared dead so she can take control of his intellectual property. And they really feel like this is their day in court. The problem was, that was a maybe naive, idealistic way of seeing it, because no one was interested in proving that Louis Laprince had invented the movies. Edison, obviously, his lawyers would have been very interested in arguing that Laprince's stuff didn't work, never worked. If it had worked, he probably wouldn't have killed himself. We know he hasn't killed himself, but we're going to suggest he maybe killed himself. All the kind of stuff you do in a courtroom to discredit a witness. And American Mutoscope, who are meant to be on the Laprince's side, at least as Lizzie and Adolf see it, they're kind of threading this needle where they need to show that a patent existed before Edison, so they can have Edison's case dismissed. But they need to stop just short of Louis Laprince invented this medium, because otherwise they expose themselves to a judge going, oh yeah, Edison doesn't own this medium, but this little family at church mice do, so you owe them money. And so Adolf goes to these preliminary hearings to court, and he's got two kind of great cards in his pocket. One of which is the patents. They exist. They were approved by the letter of the law. That's the first date on any motion picture patent. That means his father came first. And the second thing he has is he has the footage from that first successful film, from the Roundhay Garden scene. That was shot in 1888, 3 years before Thomas Edison has the first public screening or use of a kinetoscope. And that shows that not only the patent existed, but the camera was successful. And he can date the film very precisely, because his own grandmother, who's in the film, is dead by the end of October 1888. So if she's in the film and she's moving around, it must have been taken before the end of October 1888, which sounds like a really great case. But he gets into the courtroom, and Edison's lawyers sort of, you know, to generalize and simplify, attack him with this whole idea of, well, if the camera worked, why haven't we seen it for 7 years? It's a bit suspicious that it's only turning up now. How do we know this is the same camera that was in function 7 or 8 years ago? They bring in experts who say, oh, no, I've read the patent and the examiners were wrong and this never would have worked anyway. And Adolf produces the film and says, look, there is a film. It worked. And so the lawyers attack him with, how do we know this film was taken with that camera? It's 1898. You could have taken it with a kinetograph or a cinematograph or any of these other devices that exist. How do we date this back to that? Well, my grandmother died, so I couldn't have taken it now because I'm not filming ghosts. Well, how do we know it's your grandmother? And how do we know that it wasn't taken with a zoetrope? And all this stuff that really overwhelms him and that he's absolutely not prepared for. And he's counting on the mutoscope lawyers, the lawyers on his side, to stick up for him. The problem is the mutoscope lawyers are kind of banking on this idea that just because there's a patent with a date and they can bring in this kid to go, yes, my dad worked on this, it was real, he's a real person, it worked, here's the film. They were kind of banking on that being enough. And they don't really want to defend any of the arguments Edison's lawyers are making, because they might get into that very gray area of, if we argue too strongly that this worked and is motion pictures, we're exposing ourselves as well. And so they kind of leave Adolf to hang, or as he said, kind of stick him between the devil and the deep blue sea. And they keep that part of their argument too. Your Honor, there's a patent. It predates Edison. There's a film that may have been made then. The principles of that Laprince camera are sound, whether it existed or not, which proves that Thomas Edison wasn't the sole person to have come up with him, and you can't determine it beyond, you know, any doubt. And what happens, and what throws a whole kind of a extra bit of chaos into all these patent war proceedings, not just in film, but in other mediums, is that the judges that these cases come to don't know what the technical in and outs are. They don't understand half of the patent examiner debate stuff, and everybody can bring up their own expert witnesses. And obviously the name Thomas Edison, great genius, carries a lot of weight. So what happens is, in that first case, Edison wins. And the judge's decision, I quote the historian or two in the piece, the judge's decision makes no sense whatsoever. And it really is just, the kinetoscope was out first. I remember that. Thomas Edison's a genius. You know, this patent was predated, but the guy whose name it's on never sold a ticket to the thing. So how do I know? I'm going with Edison. And then there's a few more appeals, and Edison loses and loses again. And then he exploits, we're now into the early 20th century, he exploits his kind of notoriety and closeness with the patent office to do this thing that no one else would have been allowed to do, which is he files a new patent for motion pictures and essentially just asks the patent office to backdate it to the date he would like pre-LaPrince. And anybody else who would have done that would have been laughed out of the room. But some way or another, Thomas Edison suddenly gets given this new patent with a date that predates any kind of founding in fact. But what he does is put a couple of dates on his notebooks and goes, see, I was working on it then. Patent, got it. And so he files one final appeal and somehow wins, because that judge has to go, I'm not the patent office, but the patent office gave me this thing and he's got the earliest date. So Thomas Edison wins. And so in a really interesting, kind of unexpected way, this links LaPrince to movies as we know them now quite directly, because with this court victory, Edison goes around New York, goes around the East Coast, sends communiques to all the European companies who work in America through New York, and lets everybody know, this is my turf. If you want to operate here, you got to pay me, essentially. And so a bunch of companies fold and a bunch of other companies struggle, but a bunch of other ones go, no, we want to keep on making movies. We're making a lot of good money. It's a fun life. Let's go as far away from him as we can. Let's go all the way to California. We'll set up in this little place called Hollywood. Labor's cheap. Mexican border's right there if we need to avoid the law. There's mountains and deserts and beaches and oceans. And we can build little sound stages like Edison's Black Maria to make our own stuff. We don't have to stand on skyscrapers, roofs for sunlight. And in California, patent lawyers aren't that bothered. They're kind of famous for letting railroad robber barons do whatever they want to do. That'll be great. We'll just set up in that town called Hollywood. And so that court case and Edison's kind of greed for the medium almost directly leads to the center of gravity of the film industry moving away from him. And what you end up with is with a bunch of independent producers in California and then a trust in New York overseen by Edison, the Mutoscope become a part of, right? Because the second they lose that last appeal, they go to Edison, Edison goes to them, and they go, look, how do we work together? Because we actually have the infrastructure. So independent producers in California, this trust in New York, and then people in Europe making stuff, mostly in France, for their local markets. And that's kind of how it stays until World War I, where everything changes again. But it was one of those situations where the courts upheld this idea of Thomas Edison as the inventor of motion pictures. But it was more of a case of influence and argument and the legal system not quite being ready to argue all these cases that necessitated very precise and specific knowledge. And again, not in a Lex Luthor kind of way, but in any CEO of a company today kind of way, Edison was very good at taking advantage of his public image and his influence and the biases of the system to, you know, lay claim to industry. And he was one of those guys, I think, where he'd moved beyond wanting to have invented a thing. You know, I think with electricity particularly, he had this self-image of someone who was big enough and successful enough to invent public utilities, to invent mediums, to invent whole swaths of industry. And I think he saw motion pictures that way by that point.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. That goes back to what you said earlier, that he didn't operate illegally. He operated legally, but wildly unethically, but that is no different than modern day CEOs, as you noted. Well, this raises many questions about LaPrince's legacy, what it should have been. And before we get to that point, to get to the main point of your book of remembering him. There are a number of other theories about LaPrince's disappearance, since at the time he was going to display his technology, he had financial problems that any one-man invention shop would likely have, because you have to leverage every asset you have, perhaps credit beyond the assets you have, to pay for all this. What are other theories that you would discount about his disappearance that have swirled around over the decades?
So the leading theories really are, he had money trouble, so he killed himself, number one. He had personal troubles, so he killed himself, is option two. He had money troubles or personal troubles, and so he didn't kill himself, but he did that Martin Guerre kind of thing that people could still kind of do at the time, which was he just went and started another life somewhere else under a new name and was never heard from again. There's the option that he was the victim of a kind of random attack, a mugging, either on the train or in Paris or in Leeds or anywhere in between, which at the time was at least considered quite common. The newspapers loved, you know, in the same way media today loves this idea of surging crime. That was the mood kind of in France at the time, that you could be walking around Paris anytime and find yourself thrown in the Seine for your wallet. There's the option that someone close to him, you know, for some reason did something nefarious to him, that there was foul play. You know, LaPrince's brother-in-law, Jack, is sometimes brought up because he was one of those entrepreneurs who would gamble with money, who would go from failed venture to successful venture to failed venture, who had to, for a short while, leave England to escape people he owed money to. So there are people who've pointed the finger at him. And those are kind of the main theories you're dealing with as you approach it. And there's some that you can discount relatively easily, right? So if he had died by suicide, for instance, he would have had to die by suicide in such a way that his body was never found. So he would have had to figure out the scenario within which he could have died by suicide and also disguised what happened. And he would have had to have a reason to do that, knowing he had young children and a wife. And he would have had to have decided to go do that in France for some reason. And he would have had to keep that from everyone around him, because not a single person had an inkling of him being depressed or concerned or anything like that. And he would have also been doing something that is generally quite rare with instances of suicide, where he had made quite firm, hopeful plans for the future, which is, you know, every case is different, but is often considered an indicator that someone feels like they have a reason to live. And so, you know, that was one of the theories that very early on, there were so many questions I couldn't answer to make it fit. But then as I researched, there were a couple of those other theories I mentioned, where I ended up with so many questions I couldn't answer to make it not fit, if that makes sense. And the book kind of whittles it down to one final one that I feel very strongly about, where in a very nerdy kind of way, I had a kick with it, because when LaPrince disappeared, it was also the time Sherlock Holmes appears in the newspapers, right? And it's that period in history where this idea of detection and investigating becomes a thing, because up until then, you know, the authorities really mostly, you know, something happened, they went down to the place, they sought out a witness, and then they put the witnesses up in front of a magistrate. You say what happened. The judge decides, we hang one of you. It was new, this kind of idea that you could investigate and detect and make theories and use forensics and use science. And so in an unexpected way, I kind of applied a kind of Holmesian principle to it, which was I'm going to take every theory seriously, and I'm going to eliminate everything that's impossible. And you know, to paraphrase Conan Doyle, you know, whatever I'm left with, however improbable, might be the thing. And that's kind of what happened. I kind of eliminated everything until I was left with one that I just couldn't explain, and that there are inconsistencies that I can't explain and things I can't answer without going, oh, well, the answer is because that person's involved. And by digging around, and I dug very widely and had researchers and you know, going through church basement archives, looking for people's finances and notarized records and all that kind of stuff. There's also one that kind of ticks all those modern judicial boxes of, oh, well, this person had a motive and they had the means and they had. And so I get to this conclusion that, as I said, I feel really strongly about, that there is evidence for. And I think what's interesting about it is that it's very much the opposite of the myth that would make this stuff exciting and sexy for a lot of people. It's very much the opposite of it was Edison, dum, dum, dum. But it's much more tragic and human and affecting than the kind of fireworks of the supervillain.
And it's only fair that listeners read the book to find out who is responsible and how you piece this together, more interestingly, I think.
For sure. And also, that's the fun of it, right? But I'm always like, I'm one of those people with a whodunit where I don't care as much about the conclusion as I care about trying to get there before the author.
Right. You want to be along for the ride and to see when you see it explained, see how you missed it. That's the fun of these detective stories. Well, something that I think I'd love to hear you explain to tie in the story of Le Prince together. I mean, I think you can feel the tragedy and the missed opportunity because many people love the story of the poor or working class tinker inventor, the Wright brothers, other people in this 19th, 20th century era who, due to their ingenuity, due to their hardscrabble efforts, going through their perseverance, they're able to effect great change on the world. But that didn't happen. Instead, the spoils went to a man who was already prominent, already wealthy. And then the story goes along with Edison. So, but perhaps we can look at this more positively, that Le Prince did have an impact and he is remembered, but perhaps remembered better, which is what you're setting out to do. So what would you say is Le Prince's impact on centuries of filmmakers? And why is it so important to restore his place in history?
He's having a fresh impact now, which is really interesting. You know, in England, and when I came up with the idea for the book, which is nearly a decade ago, very few people kind of knew of Le Prince. And over the years that it took to sell the book and start researching the book, this really cool thing kind of happened, which was at least a small pocket of interested people in England started integrating him into the history. And so there's a filmmaker from Leeds, David Wilkinson, who made a documentary about him centered on this idea of Leeds as the first place a film was made. And people in Leeds and in Yorkshire have taken kind of local regional pride over this, as they should. And, you know, there's someone I know who kind of illustrated a graphic, kind of abridged little history of film, a kind of coffee table book. And they came out a couple of years ago. And that book takes it as a given that Le Prince was, you know, the author of the oldest surviving motion picture. And so he was really completely cut out of history for the bulk of the time cinema has been alive. And there's different reasons for that. You know, I grew up in France where the Lumiere brothers are upheld as the inventors of cinema, period. And Edison doesn't count because he didn't project images. And that's where they draw the line. And when I was a kid, that's what you learn in school. You take it as a given. It's established history. And as I researched this book, you realize just how much effort went into making that established history and how much of the way we write the history of invention is driven by nationalistic interests. You know, it's very important to the French that the Lumiere brothers be the inventor of the most defining medium of the 20th century, that it would be those guys specifically, petit bourgeois entrepreneurs with their little mustaches, whatever. I'm exaggerating, but this idea of Frenchness was tied into establishing them as the inventors in the same way that there's, as you said, an idea of American identity that's bound up with Edison. And in opposition, proponents of Edison have made the case of him as the inventor of motion pictures very deliberately. And there's a period in history where you can pinpoint this very precisely happening. So there's the invention of film, development of film. There's World War I, which kind of decimates the European film industry, but also coming out of it is when film reinvents itself as feature length in dedicated theaters for a variety of economic reasons. And this is driven by Pathé and Gaumont, which are two French companies. And Edison and his trust are getting left behind a little bit. And the traditional Hollywood studios are coming into the ascendancy. And so in the late 1920s, 1930s, there was a deliberate effort on both sides of the ocean to claim film. There was a quote-unquote historian biographer called Terry Ramsey, who wrote an approved version of how Edison invented motion pictures that became a bestseller and made his case. And then throughout the 30s, there was a whole class of French scholars and academics who called themselves Lumieristes, proponents of the Lumières, who worked very, very hard to discount Edison. That wasn't projection, it's just a toy. To discount Charles-Émile Renault, even though he was French. That was animation. Doesn't count as movies. To discount everybody else, so we can try and stick together on this idea, on this strong case as Frenchmen, that these chosen Frenchmen are our kind of candidates, Hunger Game tributes to this intellectual property throwdown. And Le Prince, because he was French, but the kind of Germany French, and he'd lived in England, and he'd moved to America, and he tried to get an American nationality and move back to England, he wasn't really anyone's to claim that cleanly as an argument. And so there were people in Yorkshire and in Leeds who had a plaque put up for him where his workshop was, who tried to write about him in the papers, but he really was just kind of a sideshow. And the thing that's really cool now, I find, is, you know, when I grew up, it was kind of like your inventor of the movies is one of these two guys. And in France, it was very much the Lumière brothers. And the same way that Edison has a myth of genius, the Lumière brothers had this myth of no one could fix motion pictures until Louis had a migraine one stormy night and it came to him in a vision and that kind of thing. And it's cool now that with people like Le Prince being integrated into the conversation, that at least it's revising the history of film more into being something like, this is something a generation was pursuing, and here are some of the milestones of how it was achieved and came to be a gigantic industry, as opposed to, this is the brainchild of specific wonderful men, which is such nonsense, but is the way we have made ourselves think of invention and innovation. And, you know, I think of Louis Le Prince as the man who invented motion pictures, because the oldest movie we have is his, because the oldest patents we have are his, because the oldest Cameron projector we have that are recognizably of that medium are his. But that doesn't mean he definitely is, right? There's a reason I work really hard to say that that little film is the oldest surviving motion picture we have, because I don't know if there's a box somewhere in France or in England where somebody made something 10 days earlier or 6 months earlier or anything like that. And also because this idea of who's the first doesn't really matter, and it's worth questioning. You know, it makes sense that we ask ourselves who's the first in a patent framework, because the law needs to determine who owns what. And I get that that's how we've built our intellectual property framework. And it makes sense if it's a sport or a race or whatever, who's the first? Well, I can look at it very clearly. But in terms of how did this medium come to be, or how are we left with moving images? It really doesn't make any difference that Louis Le Prince made a film on October 15th and Juliette and Marie made a film on October 24th and his was 12 frames per second and his was 11. Like, it makes no difference. What's really interesting is kind of how we got to that technology, what we did to it, and our conceptions of it. And my strongest feeling about Le Prince being the first, and the way I as a film lover, sort of relate to him, is that, again, he seems to be the first to have really had a vision for it and understood what it was. He wasn't just a scientist going, ah, this is a useful tool, I'll develop it. He wasn't just an industrialist going, oh, we can make a bit of money from this for 18 months before people move on to something else. He was the clearest, earliest person to go, no, this will change everything. This will change how we relate to the world. You know, the way he felt about being isolated in the siege of Paris during the war and how that potentially fed into him inventing motion pictures as a way of connection has parallels to the way we've all relied on motion pictures and moving images to get us through our own pandemic isolations. And so this idea of someone who had a vision that was ahead of its time and relates to where we are now, to me, is a much more interesting question than, did he get his patent in first? Did he sell tickets first? Which is kind of irrelevant. And so if there's anything that I hope the book kind of does, on top of being a fun read, is kind of restore, you know, not he has the oldest film, not he has the oldest patent, because, you know, again, those things exist, right? They're in the Science Museum in Bradford. They're established fact. And if that's all it took, then we would all know Louis Le Prince was the quote-unquote inventor of the movies. But it's kind of people and narratives that we're into. And I hope the book kind of conveys and reestablishes this idea of someone, a tinkerer like this guy, who wasn't backed by money and who wasn't involved in a 19th century version of Silicon Valley out in New Jersey, but it was just a guy who had a vision for a thing, and that vision was very, very prescient and in his own way progressive. And I hope he's kind of remembered that way, as someone who had a vision and an understanding for the movies, because whether he crossed the finish line first or how he defined the finish line is really a whole other inside baseball conversation.
We touch on many important themes in this conversation. how technological change happens, the cutthroat practices in the 19th and 20th century to get someone's name on a patent, what film means, the development of motion pictures over time. But we could only scratch the surface, and the story goes much deeper. And for listeners who want to check that out, find out who the real killer was, the name of the book is The Man Who Invented Motion Pictures, A True Tale of Obsession, Murder, and the Movies. Paul, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed that.
That's all for today's episode. If you'd like to see show notes with sources, maps, links, anything else related to this episode, and all my other ones as well, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network this show is a part of, along with James Early's Key Battles of American History, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, and other great history shows as well. If you'd like to support this show, the two easiest ways to do so are to subscribe to it on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second thing is to join the membership program for History Unplugged. If you do so, you'll get completely ad-free episodes for the entire back catalog, which is about 600 episodes and growing. And all you have to do is go to patreon.com/unplug. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.